outlook on lasting peace in Ethiopia has been grim since the cessation of active hostilities in November last year. A peace agreement between the Tigray's People Liberation Front, or the TPLF, and the federal government in Ethiopia has led to significant political concessions from the Tigrayans, but ultimately falls short of resolving the underlying tensions. In this episode, we look at how the mode of transactional politics has come to dominate the dynamics inside Ethiopia and what it means for the fragile state of peace. Welcome to the Conflict Zone podcast from the London School of Economics with me, Malik Banat. Together, we explore the changing nature of global conflict in the 21st century by taking a closer look at the causes and drivers of war and intractable violence. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power producing violent conflict, and how long-term sustainable peacemaking strategies can address these seemingly chronic problems. This series of Conflict Zone is produced by PeaceRap, an international research project exploring the changing nature of conflict, peace, and transition processes in the contemporary world. PeaceRap is funded by the UK Foreign, Commonwealth, and Development Office. The information and views set out in this podcast are those of our experts, and nothing herein constitutes the views of the FCDO. Today, I am pleased to be in the company of two leading voices on the security of the African continent. I'm joined by Professor Alex DeWall, the Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation, as well as the Program Director with the LSC Conflict Research Program. And here with us too is Mulugete Gebrehiwot, who is a colleague of Alex's at the World Peace Foundation, a senior fellow at the WPF. And Mulugete is also the founder and director of the Institute for Peace and Security Studies at the Addis Ababa University. Alex, you and Mulugete seem to speak the same language when it comes to explaining the transactional nature of politics, and not just in Africa. In fact, it was you who came up with an empirical explanation for this phenomenon, or as you call it, the marketization of politics. So can you explain to our listeners, what is a political marketplace? How does it come to be?
The intellectual framework that we have been developing here at World Peace Foundation and with the Conflict Resolution Program at LSE and its successor, PeaceRep, really began, in my mind at least, some 17, 18 years ago when I was working on the conflict in Darfur. And I was seconded to the African Union mediation team, which was trying to find a settlement between the Sudan government and Darfur rebels. And Mulugete actually joined me for that exercise. And one of the things that became clear was the formal process of mediation, intended to produce a formal document, but the informal bargaining between the Sudanese chief negotiator and the Darfur rebels was much more in the form of a market. He had a political budget, and he was trying to identify the price that he should pay for every individual rebel in order to secure their loyalty, to bring them round. And this led to the development of this framework of the political marketplace, which remained sadly extremely relevant in analyzing and understanding the trajectory of Sudanese and South Sudanese political dynamics and the fate of subsequent mediation efforts. Complementary to this was a series of discussions with the Ethiopian leadership, the late Prime Minister Meles Zenawi, in which he identified the challenge facing the Ethiopian government as racing ahead of a sort of cascade of troubles that would inevitably befall the country if it were not able to develop rapidly and develop not only its economy, but an institutionalized form of government. It wasn't that there was a natural progression towards, say, a barbarian state, but rather that national calamity would befall Ethiopia should the leadership not be sufficiently in command of a political and economic agenda and stay ahead of that. And sadly, what we've seen over the last decade, and particularly the last few years, is that Ethiopia has been caught in that avalanche. And the current leadership of Ethiopia set the country on a course towards becoming something much more akin to the paradigmatic African failed state, rather than aspiring to be a robust developmental state.
Mulageta, you have been observing the evolution of politics in Ethiopia through a number of successive governments and regimes. You have seen what works and what is broken. You're also the veteran of the armed struggle led by the Tigrayan forces, the TPLF, and the EPRDF, or the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Front, which is an alliance consisting of four political parties in Ethiopia. After the fall of the Socialist Republic of Ethiopia in 1991, you headed the Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Program during the EPRDF's first decade in power. Do you share Alex's outlook on events that have been occurring since?
Alex has brought the genesis of the research on political marketplace and on how it operates. I recently have been discussing about how Ethiopia is soon transiting from a centralized market into an open market. We see a genesis in Ethiopia in the last 20 years. At the time of the inception of this idea, Ethiopia was more or less a centralized market under Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. But with some serious signs of transiting into the marketization of politics. And then as the days of Prime Minister Meles Zenawi, Haile Mariam Desalegn came, and the fundamental structures of the centralized political market in Ethiopia were affected by the loss of the key note in the whole arrangement. The prime minister who has been ruling for over two decades in Ethiopia, including his times of the Liberation Army, and whose high skills and flexibility, where there was no any comparison to him, and at his absence, it was left for the crowd of peers to choose one of them to take the lead. And Haile Mariam Desalegn, a person coming from an evangelical background, a person coming from essentially an educator in a university with little experience in politics and with no background of armed struggle, came to be at the center of managing those forces, which started faltering, and a sort of oligarchy competition developed among them. And then later on, Haile Mariam couldn't manage it. He has to resign, leave it. And through Abiy Ahmed came through an unconventional way to lead the EPRDF, which eventually he transited it into a prosperity party, a centralized party at the center.
Alex, in 2016, you wrote that it was premature at that point to classify Ethiopia as a political marketplace. Now, a lot has changed since then, obviously, and a particular juncture point for us is the accession to power of Abiy Ahmed in 2018, who is the current Prime Minister of Ethiopia and the leader of the ruling Prosperity Party. What role has he played to accelerate the marketization of politics that you mentioned?
I think Abiy has actually been very explicit in his commitment to transactional politics. The very name of his party, Prosperity Party, echoes the prosperity gospel, the doctrine of the Pentecostalists. And by that, he anticipates, he sees that a sort of rather rudimentary form of individual entrepreneurial business management plus the blessings of the Almighty are the way to get ahead. He's cutting out the leftist tradition, the tradition of doing the political work of the revolution through organized political structures into individual wheeling and dealing, and having really very modest commitment to any particular set of policies, just following those that he can sell on the day. And In the run-up to the war against Tigray, you know, he confronted the Tigrayan leadership and he made the case to them. He said, you know, you will submit to me. You know, Tigrayans are like anybody else. They will, you know, submit to coercion and money. And the Tigrayans at that time rejected that. So they took a stand on principle. And then after exactly 2 years of war and perhaps a million or more dead, got to the point where the Tigrayan leadership went to the negotiating table and essentially submitted to join the Ethiopian government in a subordinate role precisely on those terms. There's really little substance, institutional substance to that agreement. It rests on the personal relationships, the goodwill and the transactional capacities of the individuals concerned. And Abiy himself relies very heavily on discretionary finance, on his political budget, on the money that he can get. And he's been demanding that the central bank print a lot of currency, which he then uses not only for state finance, but also for his personal distribution. In fact, some of the major projects that he's been undertaking, like his new palace, he doesn't even submit the accounts to parliament. He just says, yeah, these are personal endeavors. So it is his personalized financial dealings that lie at the heart of the way that in which power is being transacted in Ethiopia today.
Once again, it seems that many challenges which have been long suppressed have resurfaced since Abiy came to power and have even become uncontrollable in some respect, from basic issues of governance to inter-ethnic strife, massive displacement of peoples and starvation. This is represented in large by the humanitarian catastrophe in Tigray, triggered by armed violence in 2020. The increasing polarization and displeasure across the country is becoming more and more evident. Most recently, we can speak of the protests in the Amhara region over the federal government's plan to disband the regional forces of the Ethiopian military, a move Addis Ababa claims will lead to stronger national unity. So I guess my question to you, Mulugeta, is who is truly in control of the security situation in the country? Is it reasonable to say, at least, that the monopoly on violence is heavily contested?
Definitely, yeah. You know, earlier, you know, at the time of the inception of this thought of political marketplace, at the time when Ethiopia was described as one of a centralized state, far from political marketplace, but it was clear dangers of itself moving towards it. There was a very highly centralized and monopolized control of violence. There was a strong national defense force. There was a strong national security service agencies, very much centralized, which had the full control of violence throughout the country. There were some little things in some of the borders. There was some violence that erupted from time to time on the peripheries around the Ethiopian-Somali region, with the little attempts of ONLF's insurrection, some little attempts on the Gambela region that proliferated across the South Sudan, between South Sudan and the Gambela region. Otherwise, it was calm, highly controlled and centralized place. But despite this, however, the politics of Ethiopia began to fail. The problems are structural. They started at the time of the APRDF, when it was being led by Prime Minister Meles Zenawi. There were fundamental failures in the structure of the politics of the country, and these were expanded during Haile Mariam's period. And therefore, nationally, an anti-EPRDF as an establishment movement began to rise throughout the country. So Abiy Ahmed was part of the EPRDF leadership during Haile Mariam's period, actually. He has very key positions. He has been at INSA, the Information Network Security Agency. He has led that. He has been as a minister at Science and Technology, Minister of Science and Technology. And he has also led the office of the OPIDIO, one of the major coalition members of the APRDF, and also a parliamentarian. But when he saw the tide, he and his colleagues reinvented themselves as an anti-establishment They started financing the anti-establishment moves. They created some coalition between some of the Karirists in Oromia and the Karirists in Jhanhara. They created an unholy alliance they call Oromara. So they became the fuel providers of the riot at the bottom, while they, along with the then Prime Minister of Ethiopia, were supposed to be controlling that violence. So as a result of this initiative, Haile Mariam's state collapsed. And then it didn't take Abiy long to go and create an alliance with Isaias Afwerki. Once he took his power, he started moving around and he created an alliance with Isaias Afwerki, which has been, whose contents have been very opaque until very recently. It's only very recently that the second person in Eritrea, Haimana Gebremeskel, the second or the third person, stated it as the whole agreement has materialized by running the Tigrayan war. There were suspicions that this was an anti-Tigrayan alliance during that time, and that's what really happened. And when he mobilized this war, there was this encouragement for the proliferation of security agencies all over. You know, the regional special police forces were further strengthened. You know, the government encouraged the regions to do that because it considered them as a force multiplier in its war against Tigray. And other nationalist forces also started sponsoring their own armed groups. You see, in every part of Ethiopia, there are armed groups under different titles, which are not strictly ordered and organized by the regional states, but affiliated and usually coordinating their operations along them. You go to the Amhara region, you find an armed group under the name Fano. It's very much decentralized. They call them on localities. They call them, you know, East Amhara Fano, West Amhara Fano, North Amhara Fano, South Amhara Fano. I mean, they give them all sorts of names, but they're just armed youngsters who prey on the Amhara communities for their logistical supplies and to a certain extent some support from the government and from some private sector Amhara nationalists. You go to Oromia. Earlier there was this movement called the Kero movement, and then later on it came again through another name called Abatorbe. And then there is this OLA, O-L-A, which they call it Onegsheni. You go to the Sidama region, you go to, I mean, Ijote, they call them Ijote, there is an armed group under that name. You go to Gurage, there is another group which is called Zerma. So each region has not only this strong special police forces under its command, but also armed militias, which are loosely coordinated and loosely attached to the government, but who sort of contend to the powers and capacities of the regional authorities. As a result, when you see the formation of the Ethiopian forces on the last months of its Tigray war before it went to the Pretoria Agreement, they created a command they call Tmirtor, or a coalition of forces against the Tigrayans. And they had command for the coalition that brings commanders of these different forces together to the center. So the former, the proper command structure of the army was compromised as a result of this. I have never seen Ethiopia's violence as much decentralized as this time in my life. That's the worst thing you can see. They're telling us they have started a campaign of streamlining the regional forces, but we're not clear what their objectives are, and we're not clear on how much that initiative is going to succeed. We definitely see that violence is becoming more and more fragmented in Ethiopia. I can say I have never seen such level of decentralization of violence in my age.
And Alex, given the high risk of violence Mulugeta has just outlined, what can you say about the integrity of political and other institutions in Ethiopia? If key parts like the regional armed forces are being disbanded, are we to expect further, as you would say, marketization of institutions, where the laws and regulations in place are sold off piece by piece in exchange for political loyalty? What does this all mean for the prospects of peace?
I think one of the sort of general lessons that we can draw from the comparative study of moments of collapse or dramatic transition in Africa, also elsewhere in the world, and especially in the Middle East, is that it's so easy to dismantle institutions, but so hard to build them. And that when institutions get dismantled, either by extreme violence, civil war, or by extreme austerity, as happened in a lot of countries under the pressure of economic crisis and structural adjustment, say in the early 1980s, and as happening in some places even now. Generally speaking, when you get that collapse, then what bounces back, then what emerges from the ruins does not resemble what went before, neither in institutional form nor in political logic. What tends to happen is that these crises self-select for political entrepreneurs who are extremely adept at using money and violence within the context of transactional politics to get their way. So that what emerges from these situations is something like a political marketplace. We saw that in Somalia, in Sudan, in Chad, in Congo, in Nigeria. Nigeria was arguably the very first case, going back as early as the 1960s, during the immediate aftermath of the Biafran War. What was exceptional about Ethiopia in the crises both of 1974, the revolution, and 1991, is that this didn't happen. And in both cases, I think there's two things that stand out for why Ethiopia didn't go down that particular path. One is that Ethiopia didn't have a lot of free money. There wasn't political money in the system. In 1974, the Derg that took over was Marxist, communist. And then they turned to the Soviet Union, which didn't have free money. It had weapons. And so the mechanism for control didn't involve buying, it involved repressing. And of course, repressing can be terrible, but it didn't lead to the marketization of politics. And then the forces that triumphed, the EPRDF, hadn't used the political market. They hadn't used money. They had virtually no money themselves. But they used violence and coercion much more effectively, in a much more calibrated way, to control and achieve political objectives. And in fact, under the EPRDF, the leadership was very careful to keep money out of politics and to stop, to prevent the liberalization, especially of the financial sector and the inflow of free political money, so that those crises didn't open the door to the political market. What we're seeing now is something that has been much more characteristic of African states, as I said, since Nigeria in the days of Biafra, or indeed Congo even earlier in the 1960s. And I think that augurs ill for the development of any durable political settlement. We're much more likely to see a rather constant state of turmoil and bargaining as the future. Mulugeta, could I put a question to you, which is that in 1991, when the EPRDF marched into Addis, there was widespread fear at that time that there would be uncontrollable violence, particularly in the southern half of the country. And you were put in charge of the task of controlling the armaments, of disarming the numerous armed groups that existed at the time. And you accomplished that. So what made it possible for you to achieve that, whereas you sound extremely pessimistic about the prospects today?
During that time, during 1991, there was some sort of political settlement that people were looking into. I mean, the war continued for continuous 17 years in Ethiopia. It consumed the lives of millions, It consumed the economy of the nation. There was a negative growth continuously registered in Ethiopia for the last 4 years of the Derg regime. So people were sort of tired of. And there was a process that the EPRDF started. The EPRDF, essentially, it's the EPRDF that won the war. And then at winning the war, the EPRDF said, you know, we have to come up with an agreement, with a settlement that would allow us to transit into some form of elected government. And it called this national conference, National Transitional Conference, where something like 27 political parties in Ethiopia participated. And there was a sort of an agreement on how the transition should be managed. There was no complete political settlement, but in many of the cases, there was an agreement even to disagree and to continue working on how to resolve these issues in the future. Therefore, people from outside were expecting that massive political violence would erupt because about approximately 500,000 of soldiers were scattered throughout the country at the end of the war. But unfortunately, for many of them, it was a sort of a relief. The end of the war meant a relief. The end of the war meant for them to stop a senseless war and to rejoin their families. They only needed little things to help them begin life. One of the reasons was there was this semblance of political settlement in Ethiopia. So people hoped to see a good future, and therefore people agreed to settle in their communities. That was the key reason, I guess. The second reason was the objective of the demobilization was more or less clear. There was this task force that was created by the Transitional Council, which was composed of representatives from different political parties, which laid out how the National Defense Force was going to be organized, and which laid out what the capacities of the nation is in terms of building its security agencies, and laying out the need for a massive demobilization, not only of those soldiers of the defeated army, but also those EPRDF fighters who have been victorious, with the objective of creating a national army that has a fair representation of the nations and nationalities of Ethiopia. And there was seriously a genuine commitment of the government, the transitional government, to implement this with the objective of transiting the country into peace and tranquility. Now, when I compare it with the current situation we are here, we don't see any light towards a political settlement. It's all highly polarized. And we see coalitions being formed and then being destroyed, I mean, and moving into another forms. You know, initially, when Abiy started launching the war with Tigray, he created a coalition with the Amhara extremists and with the Eritreans. And then he pushed this to a certain extent. Immediate to the control of Tigray, and it didn't take Abiy's government to control Tigray initially. And then he started undermining this coalition and then started looking towards, you know, a sort of sidelining the Amhara militias that had collaborated with him during his initial aggression on Tigray. And therefore, started moving into another coalition. Later on, when the TDF reorganized itself, wiped the forces of aggression from Tigray, and started pushing its operations to Addis Ababa, and then he started renewing the coalition with Amhara anew. And it's only now he's going back to disarm them. So it's not something that's looking for peace, but it's something that's looking for control. Disarmament in such an environment is very unlikely to succeed. He might succeed in dismantling the bigger organizations of the Amhara forces, but he can't succeed fully, as the forces will disintegrate and melt to their communities. So violence would be further fragmented, as there is no political settlement to be seen in light.
The assessment on reaching a lasting political solution to the ails of Ethiopia is rather grim, but this could potentially entail a bigger role for external actors, like international institutions, regional organizations such as the African Union, and other foreign powers. According to both of you, Mulugeta and Alex, what role have these actors played in contributing to a resolution of the war in Tigray, and what can we expect to see in the future?
For a solid year at the beginning of the Tigray war, the EPRDF has never uttered a word. It has never had any agenda on its Peace and Security Council on the Tigray war. When all these massacres were happening, when the war was running at full scale, millions displaced, the UN Security Council was even discussing it several times. The EU was coming with statements after statements on the Tigray war. The African Union didn't say a word while sitting in Addis Ababa. Not only that, its chairperson was heard to congratulate Abiy Ahmed for a successful law enforcement operation in Tigray, as if the war in Tigray was a law enforcement of operation of the government to silence some vagabonds in some corners of the country, when all the world was shouting to stop the killings and the massacres of the Tigrayans. Again, when the whole world advised the Ethiopians not to go for elections, rather to prioritize peacemaking. And when Abiy Ahmed decided to run the general elections, the African Union, that only international institution that sent its observers to do by the leadership of Obasanjo. And this was an election that was not observed by the U.S., that was not observed by the EU. Actually, the U.S. advised Abiy to do otherwise rather than run for elections. It was an election where all the leaders of the opposition parties were in prison in Oromia, where there were 170 seats out of 548. There was no single opposition party leader left out of prison. All of them were in prison. And there was no single competitor to Prosperity Party. In Tigray, there was no election. In the Amhara region, good parts of the Amhara region, there was no election as a result of the violence. The EU said it observed, and it said this was a free and fair election, and there was a participation that has never seen in the previous elections in Ethiopia. So it essentially moved away from its principles on democracy, elections, on prioritizing human rights, and so on and so forth, and sided with the one in power and served as an instrument of power for Abiy Ahmed. So it was very clear. And lastly, when it began to engage, for example, it called three times. There were three attempts for negotiations. One was on the end of August. The invitation letter was only sent to the Tigrayans. Nobody has ever seen the invitation letter given to Abiy Ahmed, because Abiy Ahmed was clear what had a plan to complete the war and march into Murele by September 9, the beginning of Ethiopian New Year. That failed, and this was postponed. And then he had another deadline, which was the end of September and the beginning of October, which is the beginning of both parliamentarians' yearly sessions. And then it called another meeting for that. Even then, the invitation was seen for the Tigrayans and not for Abiy Ahmed. And the last one, we saw the Pretoria one. By the time it believed that the war is finished, the war is ending at the upper hand of Abiy Ahmed, it decided to call it. And it was essentially a surrender document that laid down to the Tigrayans in the negotiations, which they signed on. Did the war end? Did the balance of forces on the ground demonstrate that? I don't think so. And the Tigrayan leaders have something to account with their constituency in the future. As from what I see, most Tigrayans believe that they signed an agreement on their behalf, and an agreement that they shouldn't have signed, if that is compared to the balance of forces on the ground. I can clearly see that the African Union has been part of enforcing this marketization of politics by moving away from its original principles as set and laid out in its constituent act.
The last point I wanted to make relates to the negotiation process. And one of the features of the negotiation between the Tigrayans and the federal government under the African Union was that the African Union itself took up the principle of transactionalism as against adhering to its own norms and principles. And this can be seen in setting aside the requirements for referring the conflict to the Peace and Security Council, and also the requirement according to the protocol setting up the Peace and Security Council of 2003 that the chair of the commission, the Commissioner for Peace and Security, and their envoys report to the Peace and Security Council. And what happened was the reverse, that the Peace and Security Council was merely intermittently and occasionally briefed at the discretion of the chairperson, that's Moussa Faki, and his high representative, that's Olusegun Obasanjo. And those two essentially elevated the transactional principle over the institutions of the African Union. So the African Union became a player and a conniver in the marketization of politics. And this is something that I think we all ought to be rather disturbed about.
For now, that concludes today's podcast on the political marketplace in Ethiopia. We hope you found it informative and educational. You can find more information on the Conflict and Civicness Research Group page of the LSC website. There you can find details of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all our publications. Do make sure to follow us on Twitter at LSC_CCRG. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.